What effect will a strong US dollar have on international markets? Should you be using AIM shares to reduce inheritance tax? And is a slump in emerging markets a good entry point? Welcome to Investors Chronicle Personal Finance Podcast. I'm Emma Ajman, personal finance writer at the Investors Chronicle. And joining me today are Taha Lockhandweller, Deputy Personal Finance Editor at Investors Chronicle, and Ryan Hughes, Head of Active Portfolios at AJ Bell Investments. At the start of this year, the US dollar was relatively weak against other currencies, but the last few months have seen it strengthen substantially. Ryan, what's been driving this dollar strength against other currencies?
I think one of the main factors we've seen is the real impact of Trump's policies. We've had the much heralded tax cut come through, and that really seemed to have given a boost to the US economy, both US corporates that are profits are increasing, and also the US consumer that seems like they've decided to spend some of the windfall of the economic changes that have come through. So this is leading on quite nicely to improve US growth, and we've seen a 4% GDP number in the last print, which is clearly very, very strong, and inflation is running, you know, quite nicely. And we've seen the US Central Bank look to increase interest rates. And so all of these factors combine to make the dollar attractive, which really since April has driven that quite a lot higher.
Okay. As you're saying, it sounds like there's quite a few things causing this. Does that mean that we're likely to see a strong dollar continuing?
We've certainly seen a strong indication from the Federal Reserve that they would like to increase interest rates further, both through the rest of 2018 and into 2019. And that's looking like maybe two more rate rises this year, and the rate is currently at 2%, and maybe an additional three or four rate rises in 2019. So with that backdrop, that does look to make the US dollar attractive, both, I think, to domestic investors and overseas investors. And that should, in theory, underpin the US dollar and potentially push it higher from here, albeit it's already rallied quite strongly in the last couple of months.
And you mentioned, the effect of some of Trump's policies, but one of the other big things is this trade war that people are worried about. So how much do you think that the US dollar strength is to do with investors wanting to hold US assets because they think it's a safe haven?
I think it's probably a combination of a couple of factors. So certainly the US dollar would act, I would expect, as a safe haven should global trade, like you mentioned, become more challenged and the trade war escalates. But also, I think if you look at the yields available around the world on government debt, you can now get 3% on a 10-year US Treasury, far in excess of what you can get in other developed markets. And that makes it attractive, again, for those that are looking to invest in fixed interest. And you've also got a booming US economy, as we've mentioned, where companies are making significant profits. So there's absolutely right that the assets look attractive, and no reason why, you know, that can't continue, certainly in the short term. Longer term, I think that it does pose some other problems, but that's something perhaps for another day.
Okay. Well, maybe just touching it a little bit, you know, what kind of problems could it pose?
I think the challenge we've got, if the trade war really escalates, is what impact does that have on global growth, and how much does that take off global GDP? And then if you extrapolate that out, you have to ask the question, can the US keep growing almost in isolation if the rest of the world is slowing? Now, the US economy, despite being the largest economy in the world, is actually a very insular economy and is very reliant on domestic demand. And so it might be able to continue that growth for a while. But should that domestic demand slow down and the trade war escalate even further, then you would have to say that ultimately the US would have to slow alongside the rest of the world. But I think in the short term, it probably can continue to power ahead alone while the rest of the world looks a little bit more challenged.
Okay. So if you're saying in that short sort of medium term, it could continue to get stronger, the US dollar, what kind of assets will do well and what kind of assets do you think will do less well?
The main beneficiary, given the nature of the US economy, is actually US equities. They've performed incredibly well over the last few years. And I think with the strong dollar, we would expect those to continue to do the same. And underpinned by business investment and personal consumption, that should be good for domestic US equities and their profits to continue to grow. And of course, that tax cut benefit, whilst it's effectively a big one-off benefit, it should actually help push that consumption further and therefore profits grow again. So US equities look attractive, albeit from a very expensive base. That certainly the areas that are more challenged are really commodity markets. They struggle in the face of a very strong dollar, and you've seen the gold price fall back to around $1,200 at the moment, and it was around $1,300 for quite a long period. So gold and other commodities will be more challenged. And the other area that's really struggling is emerging markets, some countries in particular, and some Asian countries, particularly those that have got debt issued in US dollars, where their repayments to the debt holders are now looking considerably more expensive as the dollar's rallied.
And say, you mentioned US equities are likely to benefit. What kind of funds would you use to get exposure?
So there's a couple of funds that we have on the AJ Bell favourite funds list, which is our list of funds that we think are interesting for our investors to look at. I think one of the main beneficiaries on there would be the Artemis US Select Fund. That's managed by Cormac Weldon and a very, very experienced team. They have a growth bias to their investment style, and that should be a style that would benefit from the continued expansion of US profits there. And they've done very well in getting exposure to particular technology names and so on that have really been driving the market higher.
Now, we've been talking about the US, but here in the UK, we've had our own currency issues with uncertainty around Brexit, and the pound has fallen below 130 for a first time in a while. So what impact will the strength of the dollar have on sterling-based assets, do you think?
It's one of those strange quandaries that you have in the market, where actually weak sterling is good for large cap UK equities. And that's because so much of the profits of large cap UK listed companies come from overseas. So about 70% of the profits in the FTSE 100 are actually generated outside of the UK. And a lot of that is in US dollars. So when we convert those profits from US dollars back to sterling, those profits get a boost through the weaker sterling or the stronger dollar, whichever side we want to look at that, and therefore these companies continue to do very well. So weak sterling is good for the FTSE 100. It might be more challenged for other parts of the market, but certainly if you're a large cap investor, you've seen a benefit from that weak sterling, and given Brexit negotiations and where we are on that, you know, that's something that could persist over the next few months, and maybe those profits get a further boost to help underpin the FTSE 100.
Okay. So does that mean that you think that UK investors should hedge share classes in funds, as this might neutralise the impact of currency moves, or as you're saying, because we've got this sort of, you know, unusual dynamic potentially, should they not hedge share classes?
Hedging currencies is a hugely complex area and one that's fraught with danger. If you get it wrong, you may miss out on substantial returns if you get that wrong. So it's one that's very, very difficult. Right now, I think it's particularly challenged because of the nature of the Brexit negotiations. You know, essentially, the market is waiting on a binary outcome event. If the negotiations go badly and we crash out with no deal, I would certainly expect sterling to weaken further from here. That again would boost the FTSE 100 profits of those overseas earnings. So that may be beneficial to UK large cap, certainly in the short term. If we get a deal, and it's a deal that the market thinks is sustainable and likes, we could see sterling rally very sharply against the US dollar and other currencies, in which case that would be negative for FTSE 100 companies, but maybe positive for other parts of the market. So if you're choosing to hedge right now, you need to be fairly certain of how the Brexit negotiations are going to go. And I've certainly not met anyone who's certain about how that's going to play out over the next few months.
Yeah. So does that mean that you think just basically it's just best not to hedge at all then?
I think it depends on your risk appetite and your risk tolerance. If you're very, very worried about the impact of currency movements on your portfolio, then by all means hedge, because you're taking away one of those risks. But you need to understand the consequence that might come with. So if I look at the Japanese market over the last 3 years, if you're investing in a hedge share class, you actually had a return that was 50% lower over the last 3 years than if you'd simply invested on an unhedged basis. So it really can have a very material impact on the returns you get. But of course, if you're very worried about it, then simply by hedging, you will neutralise that risk.
And are there actually many funds that offer hedge share classes?
There are quite a few. I'd say it's a growing number of funds out there. I mentioned previously the Artemis US Select Fund. That does have head share class availability. Looking at other markets, Legmace in Japan. Again, you've got a choice of hedged or unhedged. Vanguard in the passive space. Their global fixed interest strategy has a hedged share class. So there are a whole wide variety around different markets where you can neutralise that currency risk if you want to.
Okay, thanks very much, Ryan. Now, growing numbers of families are getting caught out by inheritance tax. The latest figures show a record £5 billion was paid last financial year, which was 8% higher than the previous financial year, to the taxman. But Taha has been looking at one way which may help you reduce your tax liability. What is this, Taha?
So this is investing in AIM stocks. So this is the alternative investment market, which many of our listeners might be aware of, is just a sub-index below what's listed on the FTSE, the London Stock Exchange, which is just a sub-index compared to what's listed on the traditional London Stock Exchange. But what these offer is something called business property relief. And this was a rule that was created in the 70s. And what it was designed to do was allow companies to be passed on to children, etc., when the owner died without incurring inheritance tax, because it just made sense for business continuity. But what happens now is that this can be applied to a range of AIM stocks. So about two-thirds of the 1,200 AIM stocks that are out there can qualify for business property relief, assuming that they meet certain complex criteria. But that there are some stocks out there that qualify for this, and investors who aren't even linked to that company can now buy and then therefore have their capital exempt from inheritance tax as well.
Okay, and what kind of companies tend to be listed on the AIM market?
Because it's a lower level of the London Stock Exchange, so it tends to be smaller companies and newer companies. And the reason for this is that it's a lot cheaper to get listed on the AIM than it is to get listed on the London Stock Exchange. It's also less onerous. There are fewer reporting requirements and things like that, so it's a bit easier. So you tend to find slightly more nascent companies and smaller ones as well that perhaps don't have the track record or the capital to, or even need the capital to go full-blown listing.
And since they're smaller and, as you say, might not have as long of a track record, does that mean they tend to be higher risk than companies listed on main London Stock Exchange?
Probably safe to assume so, just given the very nature. So obviously there are some companies on there that will be very fast growing, and they'll be using the AIM as a stepping stone to get to go into the full-blown London Stock Exchange. But at the same time, if you on aggregate, they tend to be a lot more volatile, as you would expect with smaller companies. So just taking some figures, over 3 years, the FTSE All Shares outperformed the FTSE AIM by 122-49. And over 5 years, that's 252-88. So you can see that, you know, investing in the more traditional London Stock Exchange has definitely been more beneficial. But obviously, there are added advantages to investing in the AIM that don't exist by investing in the normal FTSE.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, BPR relief on some companies is one of them. So if you are convinced of wanting to use an AIM shares, how easy is it to do this? What's the market like?
It's easy in a sense that if you want to buy your own AIM stocks, you can do this via an ISA, and you've been able to do this for the last 5 years. In fact, this month was the 5 year anniversary of when AIM stocks were allowed to be bought via an ISA. But obviously, as I mentioned earlier, the problem is finding out which companies qualify. This is quite complex. There are certain requirements set out by HMRC as to which companies can qualify. Also, it's an ever-changing market. So if a company qualifies today for BPR, it might not qualify tomorrow. So you have to manage this quite carefully and be very aware of what you're buying and what you're not. If that's not your bag, then there's a handful of ready-made portfolios that you can buy as a private investor via some platforms that are out there. There aren't that many, unfortunately. So I've done some research and I've found about 5 that you can buy via an ISA and 4 that you can buy outside of an ISA. But if you go via a financial advisor, then the market opens up a bit more. A lot of the big wealth managers offer an AIM inheritance tax service where they pick AIM stocks deliberately for inheritance tax purposes, and they manage the portfolio and make sure that they qualify. But unfortunately, if you're doing it via a larger wealth manager, you have to be a client, or your advisor has to be a client of theirs.
Okay. And you mentioned those portfolios. So generally, how many AIM companies will a typical portfolio include?
So this is one thing that I kind of found an issue with. They tend to be quite concentrated. So they whatever money you're putting in, and the portfolios I've found have, you know, minimum buy requirements of £20,000, £50,000. So you're looking at quite sizable amounts of money. But they normally spread it across 25 to 40 stocks. And the problem you have there is that even though I mentioned there's about 800 stocks available, the portfolios seem to be crowding into very similar stocks. And the reason for this is that you're creating this Venn diagram of companies that have to qualify for BPR, but also make sure that they're not volatile and lose you lots of money. You know, there's no point being exempt from inheritance tax, but then losing half your capital in a bad company. So there seems to be, you know, an issue of kind of crowding. And I mentioned earlier that there was the 5-year anniversary. So in that 5 years since AIM stocks have been allowed to be bought via ISAs, the AIM market has actually outperformed the FTSE All Share. But you compare that with the long-term figures that I mentioned earlier, and you have to question whether that's on fundamental valuations or whether that's just people chasing IHT exemption.
That's a really good point. And it does sound like it could be a problem. What about other issues about investing in this market? What's the cost of a typical AIM portfolio?
The other thing to definitely consider, this is not cheap. So the ones I found that you can buy directly without an advisor, you're looking at annual management charges of 1.5 to 2%. So obviously what you're getting there is you're getting maybe an ISA, if you want to do it via an ISA, but you're getting portfolio management of your ISA as well, because they're picking the stocks for you. There's also dealing charges to consider. Quite a lot of them have initial charges, some as much as 4.5%. So again, these are quite high figures. Obviously, if you go the other route and go via an advisor, you have the advisor fee to consider as well. But because it's a bigger industry from the kind of intermediary side, but we're using an advisor, you would expect to probably get a lower AMC. But either way, there's certainly cost to consider here.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like the BPR relief against IHT is attractive. But then, as you say, there's all these potential issues as well. So do you really think that they're a good option for people who are looking to reduce inheritance tax?
In a certain set of circumstances, yes. Like if you if you are starting to change your portfolio away from retirement income and you are thinking significantly about how much inheritance tax you want to pay and how much you want to leave to your heirs, there's a perfectly sensible way to avoid paying inheritance tax. It's entirely fine. It's perfectly, you know, it's a normal thing to do. An advisor I speak to, if you read the piece in the magazine, he would say no more than 15%, just because of the risks of investing in these smaller companies. But if you're into your 70s and you're thinking about IHT, there's no reason why this isn't a reasonable thing to do.
Okay, thanks, Taha. And take a look at his article for more detail on AIM IHT products, including a look at the various providers. Not many people in their 80s would shun retirement to launch a new investment trust, but that's exactly what veteran emerging markets investor Mark Mabias plans to do. Taha, please tell us more about this. What's the trust going to be investing in, and when's it due to launch?
So Mark is going to launch an investment trust for small and mid-cap emerging markets. So this is, if you're a regular listener and a reader of the magazine, you'll know that he's launched a new company after leaving Franklin Templeton. So this is going to be a second fund different to the large cap normal open-ended fund that he's launched. But this is going to be small and mid-cap emerging market stocks with a strong focus on environmental, social and governance reforms. So what they're going to be doing is taking quite big stakes in these small and medium-sized companies with active ownership. So they're going to be working with the management to change the business and obviously develop capital gains over the long term. It's going to be launched in September. And apparently for Mark Mabias, it's not enough being a millionaire. So he's going to call it the Mabias Investment Trust as well. someone needs an ego to stroke, apparently.
Who will be running the trust? Will it be Mr. Mabias?
It will be him, yes, with his two former colleagues from Franklin Templeton that left the company around the same time to launch this new venture. And that's Carlos and Greg, who have worked with him across a range of funds for some time. And our readers who were invested in his emerging market funds, Franklin Templeton, will know them well.
Okay. And in the statement announcing the launch, Mr. Mabai said that now would be a great time to buy into emerging markets because the market's falling, so valuations and currencies are lower. What do you think of that argument, Ryan?
Well, it's certainly a case that emerging markets are hugely out of favour right now and are sitting at quite a substantial discount to the valuation of those developed markets. I think the key for any investor looking at emerging markets, and particularly now, is to think about their time horizon. It's likely in the short term that there could be further volatility and possibly further weakness in this market. But if you're a long-term investor, and of course we would always advocate that you are, and you're taking a good, sensible time horizon, 5 years minimum, and maybe even longer if you're putting this in your pension, you may be taking a 20-year view, then I think the emerging markets could look very attractive right now.
Okay. And what do you think about this new trust generally? Do you think it's going to offer something different to what's available in the market?
Yeah, I think it's always nice to see some innovation in the market. We're looking here at a trust that's specifically said it will focus on mid and small smaller companies, which is a positive. They've also talked about the fact that they'd incorporate some frontier market companies, so those markets that are outside of the emerging markets and perhaps a little bit less developed. And that focus on ESG is relatively new, becoming more popular, but in the emerging market space is still quite early. So it's offering a few different interesting things, and the managers come with a big reputation. So it will be interesting to see both how much in terms of assets they raise and then how the trust does in its early days.
Yes, definitely. And we were talking earlier about the slump in emerging markets. What are the reasons for this?
The main reason comes back to currency markets and the strong dollar, and also the trade war, notably between say the US and China, but pretty much the US and everyone seems to be the problem. But some of these countries have issued a huge amount of their debt in dollars. Because that was easier for them to raise funding, and these countries such as Turkey and Brazil and to some extent India, that they've really been struggling because of the movement in the currency markets is making those repayments more expensive, and we're seeing particular challenge right now in Turkey, where its currency is pretty much in free fall against the dollar and other currencies. In fact, just looking today, if you look at buying a barrel of oil in Turkey, it will now cost you $400, whereas 3 years ago it only cost you $100. So it's a huge impact on an economy, on a relatively small economy.
That's a really very stark example of that. I mean, doesn't this kind of highlight some of the risks of investing in emerging markets? I know you were saying it depends on your time horizon, but I mean, isn't emerging markets just generally more volatile?
History has borne out that emerging markets are more volatile. There is more risk that comes with it, but equally, we've seen if you get the right market and the right company, that the rewards can be very attractive. I think as long as you know those points when you go into investing in these markets, then that's absolutely fine. But it's important that you understand those characteristics at the start. You also have to understand that there might be less quality corporate governance, that those reporting standards and those accounting standards might not be quite as high, and that the information flow might not be quite as good. But that's not to say that they're all bad. And we actually have about 23% of our highest risk portfolio that we run invested in emerging markets.
Okay. And where are you invested in? What kind of funds or trusts do you use for exposure?
So we use a couple of different strategies. So we have both a passive and active strategies. In the passive side, we're using an iShares Emerging Markets ETF. On the active side, a couple of funds that we like and we use would be the Fidelity Emerging Markets Fund, managed by Nick Price, who's a very experienced manager and particularly focused on emerging Asia and also parts of emerging Europe. And then another fund we like is the Jupiter Global Emerging Markets Fund. That's a fund a little bit different. It looks at the frontier markets as well as emerging markets. And then for those that like investment trusts, I would say something like the JP Morgan Emerging Markets Trust would be interesting to look at. Got a very long-term track record and currently sits at a 12% discount, which might be interesting for some investors.
That's great. Thanks very much, Ryan. That brings us to the end of today's show, but you can read more about AIM Share Portfolios and Mark McBias's new investment trust on the website and in this week's issue of Investors Chronicle. Thank you for listening and have a great weekend.